Chapter 18. Inner storms and outer storms. Creative destruction. The length of the day and the natural reach of a biologically based consciousness. Your reality exists independently of your physically oriented consciousness, but while you are a creature, your awareness must be interpreted through your neurological structure and your corporeal aliveness. There are indeed various kinds of memory, so that the right information can be at your fingertips when you need it. Other data will seldom be required consciously, yet it must always be available to unconscious portions of the self. Biologically, the reach and capacity of your physically oriented consciousness is directly connected with the length of your days and nights, and of course with the seasons. Physically speaking, there are chemical interactions when thought occurs, and memories ride on the chemical's smooth flow. With the precise night and day schedule that it possesses, your planet would, in those terms, give birth to a creature consciousness uniquely suited to fit it. In other terms, the night and day represent the innate rhythms of your consciousness, physically materialized through natural phenomena, for you are not yet equipped to perceive longer duration days. Your nervous system would find great difficulty in a rhythm in which a day was stretched out to be 3 or 4 times as long, for instance. The rhythms of your body and of your consciousness follow the patterns of your planet. The planet itself is composed of atoms and molecules, each with their own kind of consciousness, however, and in the gestalt and cumulative cooperative organization of their nature, the physical structure is formed out of consciousness. As this formation took place, there was constant give and take between interior and exterior realities. In your terms, the growth of feelings, sensations, I-am-ness, concepts and beliefs was paralleled by the resulting exterior manifestations of animal species, and mineral and vegetable emergences. With these came the growth of complementary neurological structures, and the precise physical formations, such as mountains, valleys, seas, and so forth needed to sustain them. In greater terms, all of these events occur simultaneously. To make this easier to understand, however, I am talking in terms of your time. Your feelings are as natural a part of the environment as trees are. They have a great effect upon the weather. There are even connections that can be made, for instance, between epilepsy and earthquakes, where great energy and instability come together, affecting the physical properties of the earth. Beliefs are the formations of self-conscious minds, even as buildings are at another level. Beliefs direct, generate, focus, and harness feelings. In this context, then, feelings are being compared to mountains, lakes, and rivers. Ideas and beliefs bring about those obviously man-made structures that imply self-conscious minds and the ocean of interrelated social events. Feelings are still dependent upon your neurological structure and its impact with physical reality. An animal feels, but it does not believe. Your feelings with their chemical interactions have, beside their subjective reality to you, electromagnetic properties, as indeed your thoughts have. But your bodies must rid themselves of chemical excesses in the same way that land must clear itself of excess water. There are what I am going to call here ghost chemicals, aspects of normal chemicals that you have not perceived so far, where certain thresholds are approached in which chemicals are changed into purely electromagnetic properties, and energy released that directly affects the physical atmosphere. As your body is in a state of constant flux and chemical interaction, so is the atmosphere, which reflects on another level all of the psychic, chemical, and electromagnetic properties that exist within the body. There is little difference between the currents of blood that flow through your veins and the wind current, except that the one seems to be within you and the other without. Both are manifestations of the same interrelationship in motion. However, your planet has a body as much as you have. Your blood follows certain prescribed patterns, and so does the wind. You are inside the body of the earth in those terms. God's cells within your body influence it, so does your body affect the larger body of the earth. The weather faithfully reflects the feelings of the individuals in any given local territory. Overall weather patterns follow deeper inner rhythms of emotion. Those in earthquake regions are attracted to such spots because of their innate understanding of the astonishing relationship between exterior circumstances and their own quite private mental and emotional patterns. Here you can find individuals of great energy, of unstable, excessively temperamental natures, and with intense capacities for creativity and innovation. They need a strong stimulus or impact with reality against which to pit themselves. However, there is often a great impatience with social situations, and unusual vitality. Such individuals operate at a high pitch, and en masse emit inordinate excesses of what I have called ghost chemicals. Such emotional non-physical qualities are unstable, and affect the deep electromagnetic integrity of the Earth's structure. Obviously, there have been earthquakes where there are no people, but in all cases the origins are to be found in mental properties rather than exterior ones. Earthquakes are very often associated with periods of great social change or unrest, and from such locations the fault lines originate and are projected outward. They may then affect a generally unpopulated area on another continent, or an island, or cause a tidal wave on the other side of the world, even as a stroke might affect a portion of the body far from the original damage. You do not need a self-conscious mind to feel, and in the past, earthquakes represented the feeling patterns of species in the same way, unstable conditions of consciousness that in themselves initiated natural phenomena, further altering the state of consciousness and the conditions of species as well. In your terms, consciousness is wedded with matter, and any of its experiences are physically materialized through that interaction. There are great correlations between thunderstorms and psychic storms, for example, and between unstable electromagnetic properties of both feeling and thought, the brain's ability to handle these, and its need to rid itself of excesses. You do not simply react to the weather. You help form it, even as you breathe the air and then send it outward again. The brain is a nest of electromagnetic relationships that you do not understand. In certain terms, it is a controlled storm. From it spring ideas that are quite as natural as lightning. When lightning strikes the earth, it changes it. There are also changes that come about through the impact of your thoughts upon the atmosphere. The great overall inner trust with which you were born forms the basis for the encompassing reliability of the physical earth. Your body dwells in the earth as you dwell in your body. You were born with a faith in your existence that automatically directed the proper functioning of your personal corporeal self. This provided the necessary stabilizing properties upon which your consciousness could play, and through which it could effectively and creatively operate. The smallest atom has its own kind of built-in integrity, upon which all of its organizations and alterations are based, so generally there is a gestalt kind of permanence within the body of the earth. Yet with all of this there is always change, as with the experience of time in a linear fashion any event must knock out another one. In terms of your focus, a given occurrence takes time. You know that many events occur that you do not consciously perceive, but take on the word of others. In your terms, therefore, change is apparent. The body is altered. On other than conscious levels, simply as creatures, you are well aware of impending storms, floods, tornadoes, earthquakes, and so forth. There are many hints and signs picked up by the body itself, alterations in air pressure, magnetic orientation in terms of balance, minute electrical differentiations of which the skin itself is aware. On that level, the body is often prepared for natural calamities before they occur. Defenses are set up. Many additional issues operate, however, that have to do with any given personal reaction. Here other psychological conditions enter in. People live in regions threatened by earthquakes with clear conscious knowledge of them. Regardless of what they might say, they need and enjoy the constant stimuli and excitement. The very unpredictable nature of the circumstances arouses them to action. There are many different attitudes and characteristics that apply, so that it is difficult to make generalizations, but there are always reasons why any individual is involved in a disastrous natural catastrophe. In many cases, a near conscious realization of the circumstances occurs beforehand. In other cases, the body's foreknowledge is reflected in dreams, and so alters daily life that an escape takes place. Some people change their plans and leave town a day before a disaster comes about. Others stay. None of this is accidental. Unconscious material is admitted into consciousness according to those beliefs an individual holds about himself, his reality, and his place in it. No one dies in a disaster who has not chosen to do so. There is always some conscious recognition, however, though the individual may play tricks with himself and pretend it is not there. Even animals sense their dying ahead of time, and on that level man is no different. Those who want to use their unconscious precognition of such an event will take advantage of it, save themselves, and choose not to be involved. If they do not believe in such advance warnings and deny themselves conscious knowledge, yet still believe in their overall security, they will unconsciously act without knowledge of their reasons. There will be others who are a part of the calamity for their own reasons. Psychically, mentally and physically, they will be as much a part of such an event as, say, the water that sweeps through a town in a flood. They will utilize the physical catastrophe as an individual might use a symptom for purposes of challenge, growth, or understanding. but they will choose their disaster just as they will choose their symptoms. They will be aware of the framework, therefore, it will not be thrust upon them. They may not consciously accept such information, but if they knew how to examine themselves, they would discover that their beliefs added up to precisely the given kind of situation. An illness of a severe nature may be used by an individual to put him or her into the most intimate contact with the powers of life and death, to initiate a crisis in order to mobilize buried survival instincts, to vividly portray great points of contrast and summon all of his or her strength. So can a catastrophe be used consciously or unconsciously, according to the individual. Again, there are no accidents. No one dies under any circumstances who is not prepared to die. This applies to death through natural catastrophe as well as to any other situation. Your own choice will dictate the way you die, as well as the time. We are dealing now with your beliefs as you know them in this life, and leaving for a later chapter any bleed-throughs of beliefs that may occur from other existences. But whatever beliefs you accept, for whatever reasons, your point of power is in the present. It is far more important that you understand this than that you become overly concerned with labyrinthian, past reasons, for you can get so lost in a negative approach that you forget that these beliefs can be changed in the present. For various reasons, you hold beliefs that you can alter at any time. Many individuals die young, for example, because they believe so strongly that old age represents a degradation of the spirit and an insult to the body. They do not want to live under the conditions as they believe them to be. Some quite frankly prefer to die in what others would consider to be the most dire circumstances, swept away by the raging waves of an ocean, or crushed in an earthquake, or battered by the winds of a hurricane. Slow death in a hospital, or an experience with an illness, would be unthinkable to these same people. Some of this has to do with temperament, and with quite normal individual differences and preferences. Many more human beings are aware of their own impending deaths than is generally known. They know and yet pretend they do not know, but those who die in catastrophes choose the experience, the drama, even the terror when that occurs. They prefer to leave physical life in a blaze of perception, battling for their lives, at a point of challenge, fighting and not acquiescent. Natural disasters possess the great rousing energy of powers unleashed, of nature escaping man's discipline, and by their very characteristics also remind man of his own psyche, for in their way such profound events always involve creativity being born, rising even from the bowels of the earth, reshaping the land and the lives of men. Individual reactions follow this innate knowledge. For while man fears the unleashed power of nature and tries to protect himself from it, he revels in it and identifies with it at the same time. The more civilized man becomes, the more his social structures and practices separate him from intimate relationship with nature, and the more natural catastrophes there will be, because underneath he senses his great need for identification with nature, he will himself conjure it into earthquakes, tornadoes, and floods, so that he can once again feel not only their energy but his own. As nothing else can, a great encounter with the full energy of the elements puts man face to face with the incredible potency from which he springs. For many people, a natural calamity provides their first personal experience with the realities of creaturehood's connection with the planet. Under such conditions, men who feel a part of nothing, of no structure or family or country, can understand in a flash their comradeship with the earth, their place upon it and its energy, through suddenly recognizing that relationship they feel their own power for action. On quite a different level, riots often serve the same purpose, where the release of energy, for whatever reasons, introduces a group of individuals to the intimate recognition that highly concentrated vitality exists. They may not have found it earlier in their lives. This recognition can lead them, and often does, to seize their own energy and use it in a strong creative manner. A natural catastrophe or a riot are both energy baths, potent and highly positive in their ways despite their obvious connotations. In your terms, this in no way absolves those who start riots, for example, for they will be working within a system of conscious beliefs in which violence begets violence. Yet even here individual differences apply. The inciters of riots are often searching for die manifestation of energy which they do not believe they possess on their own. They light and start psychological fires, and are as transfixed by the results as any arsonist. If they understood and could experience power and energy in themselves, they would not need such tactics. As racial problems may be worked out on many levels, through a riot or a natural disaster, or a combination of both, according to the intensity of the situation on a psychological level, and as physical symptoms can be pleas for help and recognition, so can natural misfortunes be utilized by members of one portion of the country, or one part of the world, to obtain aid from other portions. Obviously, many riots are quite consciously instigated. Certainly thousands of individuals, or millions of them, do not consciously decide to bring about a hurricane, or a flood or an earthquake, in the same manner. In the first place, on that level they do not believe such a thing possible. While conscious beliefs have a part to play in such cases, on an individual basis the inner work is done just as unconsciously as the body produces physical symptoms. The symptoms often seem to be inflicted upon the body, just as a natural disaster seems to be visited upon the body of the earth. Sudden illnesses are thought of as frightening and unpredictable, with the sufferer a victim, perhaps, of a virus. Sudden tornadoes or earthquakes are seen in the same light, as the result of air currents and temperature, or fault lines instead of viruses. The basic causes of both, however, are the same. There are as many reasons then for earth illnesses as there are for body illnesses. To some extent the same can be said of wars. If you consider a war as a small infection, in the case of a world war, it would be a massive disease. War will finally teach you to revere life. Natural catastrophes will remind you that you cannot ignore your planet or your creaturehood. At the same time, such experiences themselves provide contact with the deepest energies of your being, even when they are being used destructively. Natural disasters are brought about more at an emotional level than at a belief level, though beliefs have an important part to play, for they generate the emotions to begin with. The overall emotional tone or feeling level of masses of people, through their body connections with the environment, brings about the exterior physical conditions that initiate such an onslaught of natural energy. Seth describes feeling tones in the 613th session in Chapter 1. According to the mass emotional conditions, various excesses are built up physically. These are then thrown off into the atmosphere in different form. The ghost chemicals mentioned earlier, in the last session, play a part here, and the electromagnetic properties of emotions. A rock and a stream will divide the water so that it must flow around the impediment. Your emotions are quite as real as rocks. Your collective feelings affect the flow of energy and their force, in terms of natural phenomena, can be seen quite clearly in a thunderstorm, which is the exteriorized local materialization of the inner emotional state of the people experiencing the storm. As your conscious beliefs determine your bodily condition, and as your body is maintained at an unconscious level, though in line with your beliefs, so natural catastrophes are the result of the beliefs that give rise to emotional states which are then automatically transformed into exterior atmospheric conditions. Then, according to your beliefs, you deal with the physical dilemma as it is presented in those terms. You will react individually with your own purposes in mind. Your own unique and highly private beliefs help bring about the overall emotional condition. The pool of emotional energy into which your emotions flow is still composed of unlike charges, but generally speaking, the individual contribution of all those participating will fall into a coherent pattern that gives impetus and direction to the storm, providing their charge and the power behind it. As mentioned earlier in this book, Rupert and Joseph were both involved in a flood situation, in June, 1972, and so I will use that as a case in point and this specific area in particular, although the flood itself was much more far-reaching. Locally, there were some general beliefs held. The Elmira region was economically depressed and considered to be in a backwash area of the state of New York, yet the condition was not bad enough for crisis aid. Industry had been moving away. People were out of work. The old routines of livelihood had been uprooted. There was no inspiring local leadership, and a variety of different kinds of individuals felt ill at ease, depressed and forced to the wall. Urban renewal projects ripped up the homes of the poor and destroyed older established neighborhoods. This often involved social divisions, for the impoverished were a mixture of blacks and lower-class whites. The better off sat at city councils, however, and the displaced poor were not able to afford the new structures. Through various manipulations, all underground, they were kept out of the better neighborhoods. The rich and well-to-do felt threatened, for they had changed the status quo by their insistence upon modernity and progress, thus releasing the energy of the needy. There was movement of the middle class from the city proper into the suburbs, with a change in the tax balance, and the city merchants began to suffer. The locality had no great sense of unity as a region, or overall pride in itself as a cultural or natural identity. There was some racial tension, hints of impending riots that did not occur. A very capable mayor who had been in office for some time was defeated. Politics entered in, for many reasons not necessary to this discussion. Politically oriented people felt that they had no really strong hold, so that effective communication with the federal government could not be expected. In that area, a sense of powerlessness grew. Culturally, the region did not have its own identity, though it has always striven for some kind of characteristic expression. It saw government funds go past it to other sectors more economically depressed. The people had individual dreams and hopes, and en masse these represented a regional vision of improvement at many levels. At the same time, feelings of discouragement grew. The young and the old, the conventional and the unconventional, had small skirmishes, where some of the city fathers objected to the long-haired youths in a city park. Quite trivial incidents, and yet indicative of splits of values and misunderstandings between the generations. To one extent or another, these same problems existed in all areas of the East Coast that were directly involved with that particular flood. Locally, you had a depressed region not yet in the kind of crisis situation that would draw great federal funds, and highly unstable social and economic conditions coupled with a sense of hopelessness. Instead of a flood, disastrous social upheavals could have erupted. Because of the peculiar, unique and characteristic feeling tones involved, however, the resulting emotional tensions were released, automatically transformed, into the atmosphere. A natural catastrophe provided many answers. The Kemung River was close by, directly in the heart of the business section of Elmira, for example. Again, all of this involved other areas affected by the flood. As certain primitives do rain dances and consciously bring about rain, deliberately directing unconscious forces, so the people in these different places did the same thing quite automatically, without awareness of the processes involved. They seeded the clouds therefore through unconscious intent, and through the spontaneous release of emotional states operating biologically, so that excess hormonal and chemical reactions directly affected the atmosphere. Some time earlier, local religious organizations had made plans for a mass revival. Followers of a popular religious group were signed up and some considerable publicity given for the event. Again, this was not accidental. It was an attempt on the part of fundamental denominations to solve the problems at another level, through an influx of religious identification, conversion, and enthusiasm. The beliefs upon which these plans were based did not correlate, however, with the mass beliefs of the populace, and so the attempt failed. The program was based on precognitive knowledge of the flood event. The crusade never took place, for the revivalist organization was frightened away by the flood. Many in the religious community said that the flood was the will of God at that level, or that people were being punished for their transgressions. In its own way, the flood was a religious event, for it united diverse groups of people, who did not always have the most humanistic of intents, with the community. In a strange way, it also served to isolate certain portions of the people, and to highlight their predicament in a way that no riot could. It also humbled some, denying them the comfort of social position and belongings at least momentarily, and brought them face to face with others of varying backgrounds with whom they would not have become acquainted otherwise. Crises such as this provide spotlighted views of reality, in which what has been hidden is suddenly only too apparent. In many cases, the poor were saved, for most of the old homes and apartment houses survived, while the newer ranch-style homes could not stand the onslaught of the water. Yet the college, Elmira College, still found itself with many of the dispossessed needy at its doorstep. Women who had no stronger purpose than playing bridge ended up struggling for survival beside their more destitute sisters. Many of the poor who lost their living quarters discovered qualities of leadership in themselves that astonished them. The downtown area saw its inner, always known but hidden predicament, physically materialized. It was in a state of near ruin and needed drastic help. City government was suddenly confronted with a reality that had little to do with conference rooms. The crisis united the people. The feeling of hopelessness was out in the open for all to see, and therefore action could be taken. There were old people, laden with negative beliefs about age, who discovered great vitality and further purpose under the stimuli of survival. There were people blinded and lost by a belief in the supreme importance of things, who found themselves with nothing left. They realized the relative unimportance of belongings, and felt within themselves the stirring of a freedom they had not experienced since youth. The hidden illness of the area was plain for everyone to see. People came from all around to help. For once, comradeship ignored social structure. taken for granted patterns of existence had been ripped away quite effectively in a day's time. To one extent or another, each individual involved saw himself in clear personal relationship with the nature of his life thus far, and sensed his kinship with the community. More than this, however, each human being felt the enduring energy of nature and was reminded, even in the seeming unpredictability of the flood, of the great permanent stability upon which normal life is based. The power of the water put each individual in touch with intimate recognition of his dependence upon nature, and made him question values taken for granted too long. Such a crisis automatically forces each person to examine values, to make instant choices that will provide him with recognitions to which he had been blind earlier. The flood therefore physically materialized the inner problems of the region, and at the same time released energies that had been trapped in hopelessness. The area became a psychic and physical focus point of attention, thereby attracting other energy to it. Each individual involved had his or her own reasons for participating, and through the mass-created framework, worked out private purposes and dilemmas. Many past beliefs were automatically shattered in the reality of the moment. Powers of initiation and action, long buried, were released in numberless individuals. Federal funds were directed instantly to this region. The spotlight was turned on to the section. Many lonely people were forced, or rather forced themselves, into a situation where it was imperative that they relate with others. Since this is not the main topic of this book, I cannot go deeply into the ways and means involved. As a case in point, however, we will deal with Rupert's and Joseph's experience with the flood situation, for their participation will have application to many others. Now, do you want to know why you stayed in our living quarters during the flood? And none of it should be mysterious to you. The reasons and the habits were all quite consciously available. Now, dictation. Rupert and Joseph, as Seth calls Jane and me, have always seen themselves in a one-to-one relationship with nature and with the universe. They are individually motivated, in a sense loners. They shy away from large groups. Nevertheless, it was surprising to many that these two stayed here during the flood. To some it seemed quite foolhardy. In one manner of speaking, however, Rupert and Joseph were quite prepared. Since the Bay of Pigs, they had kept a small pantry of stocked food, pure water in old wine jugs, candles, and a transistor radio. But they were not looking for a disaster. Seth didn't say that we also had a small bore rifle, which has yet to be fired, even now, and a few medical supplies in our stock. In April, 1961. A group of Cuban exiles landed at Cuba's Bahia de Cochinos, Bay of Pigs, in a disastrous attempt to overthrow the regime of Fidel Castro. The confrontation between the United States and Russia over the latter's missiles in Cuba followed in October, 1962, so once again it had seemed like a good idea to have supplies on hand. Before Rupert became involved in psychic work, he wrote a short novel, Bundu *, in which nuclear destruction had taken place. For reference, he read up on requirements for survival. Later, at the time of the Bay of Pigs, the necessary supplies were purchased. Quite as a matter of course, household habits were such that those procedures were maintained almost automatically. There was always a stock of candles and food and water. No stress was laid on these provisions. When the flood came, however, Rupert and Joseph found themselves, in that way at least, prepared to go without help from the outside world if necessary. All of this had to do with past conscious decisions and responses to situations that, in your terms, no longer existed at the time of the flood. Yet the pattern of reaction was clear. They had decided to face any great crisis together in their own territory. The beliefs that led to their decision to stay had not changed in that regard. The one-to-one feeling of involvement with nature operated strongly here. They would take their chances then on individual basis. Now they were also used to working alone, even while together. In their artistic endeavors and psychic work, they were acclimated to trusting themselves. Their past involved camping out, and, at least once, in very primitive surroundings, in Baja California. This, again, deepened their intimate sense of relationship with nature, and encouraged their tendency to go along with it, to survive within its context rather than combat it. With this set of beliefs, attitudes and background, their decision to stay was highly predictable. They knew there was a third story to the house they lived in. Therefore they planned to move our manuscripts, Rupert's writings, and Joseph's paintings upstairs if the need arose. Other elements were also involved. For one thing, of course, They lived, and still do, on the second floor. The crisis brought many of their attitudes into critical awareness. The situation did become so serious that for a while they did fear for their survival. In those few moments they saw their life situation clearly and brilliantly in symbolic focus. For they were isolated, with nearly 10 feet of water rapidly ascending, and carrying with it the odor of fumes that could be combustible. They had told no one in authority of their decision to remain, and had instead closed all the curtains so that others would not be aware of their presence. At the moment of their fear, help from outside was impossible. Helicopters could not land. They found themselves alone with SF material, their paintings, and other manuscripts of Rupert's. They had been using the mild version of self-hypnosis to produce a calmness and produce any panic. But it was Joseph who suggested that Rupert tune in to discover what could be learned about their situation personally. Now, because of their knowledge and temperaments, they had already begun to play cards, to distract their conscious attention, and to drink wine to help reduce tension. Rupert then went into an altered state of consciousness, and quite correctly foresaw their situation. The bridge a mere half a block away would collapse, but they would be safe as long as they did not panic and try to leave. The crisis would be over by 5 o'clock, even though the news media would not realize it. As soon as the information was received, both of them felt more at ease, and the panic that had at least threatened vanished. They were left to observe the physical phenomenon, still watching the waters rise but with the inner knowledge of safety. Rupert needed the experience in order to gain added faith in his own abilities. Both of them needed the assurance that those abilities are natural, and can be used in private dealings with nature. Rupert also found that he had put himself in a position in which he had underrated the importance of physical manipulation. Both Rupert and Joseph are very mental people, however, and so they sought out this physical meeting with material phenomena and solved the problem according to their beliefs. Now those who have a great faith in groups, who work primarily with others, left their homes immediately for the comfort they found with the companionship of their neighbors. Rupert and Joseph discovered their own attitudes in a crisis situation, clearly delineating their psychic position. They were led to question why they chose to face the flood alone. In other terms, the flood waters became the waters of time, and of the passage of the phenomenal world. Despite all natural personal problems, they had taken their stand. The waters receded as Rupert had predicted. They were forced to face the aftermath. Joseph helped physically as the other tenants returned to their apartments. He worked at the quite physical labor involved. Both Rupert and Joseph threw open their two apartments. A couple was given shelter in one apartment while Rupert and Joseph confined themselves to the other. Here they found themselves in daily intimate contact with others in a way not usual for them. This particular situation made clear to them important insights that were invaluable. It also showed them that through their own relationship, they still did interact with others. For a short period of time after the water receded, there were excited radio recommendations, clinics were set up and the populace was told that tetanus injections were imperative. Again Rupert tuned in, altered his state of consciousness, and was told not to take them. Joseph was not to have them either. The unconscious knowledge was given, pause, and statements of each body's condition. Both were safe as long as shots were not taken. In this case Rupert and Joseph acted in direct contradiction to authoritative radio statements, and held their own despite the fact that others in the immediate environment rushed off to the medical centers. They placed their lives on the line. Only an hour later the radio announcements completely changed. People were told that they did not need shots, and that indeed the inoculations could cause severe reactions. Again, Rupert and Joseph gained necessary confidence that would be used in other areas. In ways too numerous and personal to enumerate, the conditions of their lives became clear to them. They did not enjoy living in a cold, sodden environment for several weeks. They did not look forward to all of the inconveniences involved, and yet for their own reasons they chose to be part of the flood. Only a few days before it took place, Rupert was offered a television engagement in Baltimore, and refused it. Their car was submerged. Income from Rupert's classes was lost, yet these side effects were chosen quite in line with Rupert's and Joseph's conscious beliefs, habits, and practices. The same applied to everyone else involved. On symbolic levels, a flood represents a washing away of the old. Of course, the sweeping power and energy of unconscious forces and the resulting emergence of new birth. The fact is that our society often involves you in petty annoyances and problems that do not bring out your full strengths, Disasters often serve as encounters with nature, in which you can experience the great power and range of your own identities in a situation in which you are pushed to the utmost. In a highly materialistic society, the loss of an expensive home and other material possessions is a matter of great practical and symbolic nature. Many individuals therefore sought out that experience. Long pause. Many also found themselves reacting with a heroism they did not realize they possessed. A sense of community unity was born, a deep feeling of companionship that had not existed earlier. War has often served as an emotional stimulus, as an escape in terms of drama, excitement and belonging for those who have felt alone, powerless and isolated. In its own way, a neighborhood fire serves the same purpose, among others. And so does a local or regional disaster. The nature of your conscious mind demands change and dramatic meaning, a sense of power, and aspirations against which to judge individual direction. A perfect society, idealistically speaking, would provide these qualities by encouraging each individual to use his potentials to the fullest, to revel in his challenges, and to be led on by his great natural excitement as he tries to extend powers of creative potency in his own unique way. When such opportunities are denied, then there are riots, wars, and natural catastrophes. A sense of power is any creature's right. I speak here again of power as the ability to act creatively and with some effectiveness. A dog chained too long often becomes vicious. A man who believes his actions have no value seeks out situations in which he uses his power to act, yet often without worrying about whether the action will have a constructive or negative effect. You cannot act positively if you cannot act. You do not understand the nature, then, of your own energy or your ability to direct it. Storms, say, or tornadoes, are brought about by angry men precisely as wars are. They are simply versions of the same phenomena. The flood represented a mass psychic symptom projected upon the earth. In a quite natural manner, all of those involved not only chose the situation but helped in the healing process that still continues over 11 months later. But you can no more separate yourselves from the body of the earth and its condition than you can from your own bodies. Though it may not seem so to you, these are all creative procedures, and corrective ones. Long pause. You intuitively feel a great connection between your individual subjective moods and the weather, yet you attribute this to mean that you are reacting to exterior physical events that exist quite independently of yourselves. This is hardly the case. When you move from one area of the country to another, it is because you have changed, and so you are drawn to others with the same kind of beliefs and needs, attracted therefore by entirely different natural situations. You will then help perpetuate the characteristic climate to which you travel.